You are listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network.
Welcome to the Screamcast, episode 147. I am Sean DeRager, and with me is Stephanie Crawford.
Hello.
Also joining us is Brad Henderson.
It's hot in this room. I got to turn my fan on. Hello.
Okay. Jeez. BJ is in L.A. doing L.A. shit. If you all didn't know, she got a job with Dread Central. She is out at some convention repping it with Dread Central. It's a something. Damn.
American Film Market.
Yeah. American Film Market. She's about to do some Dread Central karaoke. So I kind of wish I was there. But anyway, she should be joining us soon. I know people have been asking. But in the meantime, we will keep the show going. Today on the podcast, we are going to do basically an extended What's on Your Doorstep episode. We've been watching a lot of things. We try to leave things out so we can kind of get through that segment quickly. Brad, you figured we might as well just do a full-on episode and kind of get these backlogs just taken care of.
Sure. Yeah, that's a great idea.
So thanks for that idea.
Cool. I'm excited. I'm super excited.
All right.
And I'm beyond thrilled right now.
Okay, perfect.
Are you thrilled?
Yeah.
Ecstatic.
Man, that's, I could hear it in your voice.
All right, and with that, let's jump into What's on Your Doorstep.
Holy cow, I almost forgot.
We'll get the door.
Okay.
Who would like to go first?
Maybe you could do like a round table.
What do you mean by a round table, Brad?
Or round robin? Is that what the old folks call it? Old round robin?
One title each?
You're never like in a meeting and they're like, okay, round robin.
Yeah, whenever we do that, all of us say, got nothing, got nothing. Let's get the fuck out of here. Got nothing.
Well, if we did that, then that wouldn't be very good. But yeah, I guess
it's like the one person that like has something that we all go, fuck.
Yeah, it's because people love meetings. They want to push those meetings over and over. Like our hospital, like the basis of it is meetings. Like it's the most ridiculous things. Like no joke. I've been in two meetings this year where it's a meeting about having a meeting. And like I feel like I'm in some kind of Seinfeld Curb Your Enthusiasm episode where I'm like just laughing because I was like, does anybody else like realize how ridiculous this is? But it's the corporate people, man. Like I hate being a corporate person because I have to deal with that shit.
Yeah.
But anyways, yeah. So let's just maybe go around the table and – you know, that way, because I know a lot of us have, like, duplicates, and some of us has seen, you know, each other's films, and I can't wait to fucking debate certain things, so.
Okay. All right.
So we're going to copy the format you hate at work.
Awesome. Yeah.
Let's go.
Yes. Let's do this.
I'm going to be super pleasant during this episode, just to let you guys know. I'm, like, super happy.
Oh, man.
Now, Brad, I asked you this Did I ever bring up Future Shock, the documentary, on the podcast?
I don't remember.
I don't think I did. I think I'm okay. All right.
When did you ask me that?
I texted you before the show, so I wouldn't sound like a moron asking you on air. But you know, it's fine.
What's even more moronic is that you didn't actually ask me about Future Shock. You asked me about The Exterminator.
Oh yeah, that too.
Idiot.
I suck.
Yes, you did talk about The Exterminator because I said it would. It's a movie that should be like during that whole.
That's right. Okay.
The Charleston thing. I said, man, this would be a good time for everybody to watch The Exterminator.
yeah, that's right.
So,
All right. How's cleaning done? Sorry, everybody. Sorry you had to sit through that. So my list is super small. So the round robin's not going to work. So I'll end up dropping out like halfway through. But that's fine. I'll try to talk about other things.
We can make it fun. Fun.
All right, here we go.
Roast us.
I will start it off.
Start off with a joke.
And I have no jokes right now.
How about a safety moment?
All right, everybody, just make sure when you're walking from your car to the office, make sure you're not looking down at your phone or texting, and don't hold your – you better not be on the phone and walking at the same time, because that can cause a problem, okay?
Is that a character you're working on?
Literally, that's like my office.
But is that a character you're working on, Sean? Is that like a new like persona?
Yeah,
like we have a fifth host now, but it's that person.
Okay. No,
I'd like to call out.
That's
sick
a South
today,
Park.
Please. Okay.
What'd you say, Steph?
I'd like to call out sick today, please. That's okay.
Yeah, is it too late just to, like, log off the call? Oh, man, going through a tunnel.
And if it's hot outside, make sure wear sunscreen. Make sure that happens.
All right.
Hydrate, everybody. Okay, so I'll start. So Severin put out – I feel like I mentioned this before or not. I can't remember. Maybe I was talking about it with Josh on a segment. But Severin released – Future Shock, the story of 2000 AD, is a comic book out of the in Great Britain near the end of the 70s, and it pushed a lot of boundaries artistically. I know that Arrow Films put this out as well, and it's a really great documentary. Even if you hadn't read this comic book, just all the interviews with everyone involved. I believe Neil Gaiman's interviewed, Grant Morrison, Dave Gibbons, and a bunch of other artists are interviewed in this. It's really great if you're a fan of art and comic books. They talk a lot about the Judge Dredd comic was kind of came out of that this comic book. So really great documentary if you're into all that.
So is it like a certain line of comics, or is it like an artist?
It was called the 2000 AD. That was the comic. And it was like –
All right,
you know,
so the comic is called 2000 AD.
Yeah, but there was like a bunch of stories in each one. You know what I mean? Kind of like Heavy Metal magazine, you know?
Okay.
So anyway, very, you know, it was very punk rock, very, like they wanted to go away from, you know, kind of the mainstream comics. And anything went, it was, you know, sex and violence and all that stuff.
Was this in like the 90s, 80s, 70s?
No, late 70s. And then that's when it came out in the late 70s and through the 80s. And then, like I said, gave birth to Judge Dredd. And Judge Dredd was like a huge deal because it was like, you know, that character was just, you know, take no prisoners. And just it was just so violent, like to have kind of an anti-hero like him. But anyway, really cool, like really made me want to kind of track down some of these comics and everything. So if you're a fan of that, definitely.
I have that doc. I just haven't watched it
yet. Yeah, it's awesome. And it's, you know, anything in like the punk rock spirit, I'm always gonna give a try, and it's kind of, you know, inspiring documentary. Kind of makes me want to pick up a pen and maybe start drawing some shit again. But definitely would recommend it. Either the Arrow one or the Severin one, whichever one is easiest to get. I would say grab it.
Why'd you just brush over that you draw?
What? I dabbled. Yeah, I dabbled. It's one of those things, hidden talents that I need to kind of break out again. You know,
so
one of those things I stopped doing and I need to start doing it again.
I'm liking this. We're learning things about each other.
Yeah.
This is good.
I had a cartoon strip called Macabre High, and it was a bunch of tattooed and pierced little punk rock guys kind of going to like a monster school. So
how do you feel about Monster High?
You know what? Macabre High was before Monster High. I did it first. No one saw it.
Like, you ever look at that and said, that should be my money?
Yes.
You know what you should do is you should contact Kmart and have a line of Macabre High dolls. Because Kmart's not doing so hot these days.
Right.
And I remember Kmart used to be like the shit. And then like you can't even find a Kmart. And then, like, Kmart was doing this weird, like layaway thing, or like, hey, put this kayak on like layaway, and it's like, what? Like, why are you advertised? I'm being dead serious.
Dude, layaway used to be the thing. Like, so many people used to do layaway.
Yeah, I just don't get it. But anyways, okay.
All right, so that's my first one.
I would contact Kmart.
Okay, we'll do.
Yeah.
Apologies if you hear snorting and sneezing in the background. My dog basically did a line of dirt in the backyard and scared the shit out of everyone. He's been sneezing ever since. So, you know, that's what you'll hear every now and then as I talk.
Is that the whining that I hear?
Well, they're fighting as usual. Whenever I record now, I got two dogs at my feet fighting. But now he'll go into like little sneezing spats. So good times. Nothing but professionalism at the Screamcast.
That sounds really fun. All right, Steph.
What?
You go.
What?
Yeah, or you want me to go? Okay, I'll go. I'll go. Okay, fine. I'll go. I don't know if I talked about this. I'm like Sean right now. I buy a lot of the Eureka titles because I feel like Eureka's like another, like as far as like how awesome Indicator is and Arrow in the UK, I think Eureka is a little like underrated. They do a lot of good work. I mean, they have like their HD Masters that they do here and there, but they did a great scan for Fright Night. And then I got around to watching, this is a weird one to cover, but I remember seeing this when I was little and I haven't revisited. There's two films I remember when I was little: Born Free, which is this one, and then Baby, which I think we talked about before, about the fucking dinosaur.
Oh, I love that movie so much.
That was my childhood.
And I had a movie book based on Baby. It was amazing.
Yeah. So there's two films I remember watching a lot when I was a kid, and one was Baby and the other one was Born Free, which, you know, Born Free is based on a true story. It's this game warden is forced to kill, you know, the lion and lioness that are hunting, you know, just trying to, what do you call it, just kind of call back. You know, the breeding and how much, because they're starting to, you know, hunt outside their territories. So whenever they do that, they kill this lion and lioness, and then they realize that there's three cubs that they that are abandoned now because they killed their mom and dad. So the woman is played by Virginia McKenna, I think that's her name, and it feels bad. They both feel bad. So they adopt these three baby cubs. And you know, they try their best to, you know, they're going to get a little emotionally attached to them, and they realize that, you know, they can't take care of three fucking lions. So they're going to give them away, you know, to the zoo. But she gets attached to this one that's very playful and, you know, kind of takes to her a little bit. So she kind of feels like a mom because she can't have kids and stuff like that. So she keeps one of the cubs and she raises it. And it's basically just kind of a cute family type thing. You know, the lion gets in a bunch of shit, you know, and causes ruckus. And there's a bunch of other animals on the kind of this outback that they live in. Kind of like, not really a farm, but I can't remember where the movie, just like kind of like on the coast of Africa, I think is where they are. So it's kind of like beachy, resortish, but it's also very much like The Cabin in Roar, if you ever watched that one. The fucking just lions attack everybody, which is one of the most insane movies ever. But anyways, it's, you know, just growing up, and they realize that once the lion becomes, you know, a lion. A lioness, I can't remember, I think, yeah, it's a lioness. They have to do something because they can't take care of this thing. So it's basically setting it free. So it's just that continuation of a story, mainly very much like a child, you know, how the lion is brought into the family. So it's very sweet. It's very sad. It's just like a fun little family movie. So if you haven't seen it, I suggest checking out with your kids. It's from the 70s too.
Will it make my children cry?
No, it's not really. It's not like that.
They don't
it's,
go Old Yeller.
Oh no, 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 no.
or that Marley and Me.
I haven't watched that movie.
Hey kids, come watch this movie. We're gonna punch you in the gut.
It's not like that. It's trying to get this lion, you know, because they have to release it back in the wild, very much kind of like what zoos do is they rehabilitate animals and get them prepared, you know, teach them kind of little hunting skills because this lion doesn't have parents. So they teach it and they prepare it for a release back into the wild rather than putting it in a zoo. But the woman is attached to it because she can't have children, so she looks at it like a child. So it's, you know, like adopting a child because you can't have one and then sending the child off to college. Make sense? There you go.
Perfect.
Aww. So no, it's just a cute family movie. You know, and not violent, you know, not like, I mean, it's sad, but in a more happy way. Like when Shadow comes over the mountain and Homeward Bound.
Aw. Okay. All right. That sounds like the kind of thing I like to watch in the summer.
Yeah. So Born Free is definitely a high rec. You know, it's weird because it's one of those films that I grew up on, but I haven't watched in probably 30 years.
Meanwhile, listeners are all saying, fuck these guys.
Hey, no, hardcore horror people like this type of shit too.
I know. Okay, good.
Don't put us all in a box, Sean.
Out of that box.
We're a layered people.
I do. Right. I mean, my list is very much out of the box, so. Okay.
All right, go ahead.
Steph.
All right. I will keep the 70s trend going.
Yeah.
And I just watched this one. And I got pretty hepped up about it. It's Jennifer from 1978.
Yeah, Jennifer's fun.
This was released by Kino and Scorpion, and I grabbed it during the last Kino sale because that was a great cover of the girl holding up snakes in her fists. And it's one of those ones I kept looking at. Finally, I had to get it. And I'm glad I did. The cover says makes Carrie look like an angel. And that's pretty true, except it's not her. These are some of the most fucked up bullies I've ever seen. Well, mainly the lead girl. But Jennifer herself, she's very sweet. She's a scholarship student at her boarding school, but she's local. She lives with her father. They own a pet store. And we find out that they used to be in those that snake handling religion. And the father's still pretty tied to it. But Jennifer's like, no, that was fucked up. That was evil. And it turned out she was like a chosen one, like a child who was really great at snake handling. And he keeps telling her she has a gift. And she's like, no, man, I'm not a snake handler. I'm a regular high school girl. But she's teased because she's poor and she has an accent. And the headmistress says to a teacher that rich is right. No matter what happens, she always sides with the rich kids. And I started like yanking at my hair because this is, I'll go into a little bit of spoilers, but we get animal torture and murder. In this, as a bullying tactic, we have like endangerment with nude photography of a teenage girl. A girl pisses off the main bully, so she has her raped. I mean, when you look at Carrie, it really is much more intense. And Jennifer, she's such a sweet character, and she's so patient through the whole thing. Oh my God, it's like the revenge is coming. The only reason I can put up with any of this is because the revenge is coming. And I think it should have been more drawn out. I think these people should have been tortured quite a bit more, but still paid off. A lot of great snake stunts. It was a lot of fun. A lot of people told me it wasn't that great, but if you're into 1970s revenge films, it's pretty fun.
Yeah, I think people compare it too much like, oh, it's a Carrie ripoff. And it's like, you know, coming for me, I'm not a huge fan of Carrie all that much, and Jennifer's more my speed. So I've always been a fan of that one. I agree with you that, you know, it's like the momentum's built up so much, and then once it hits, it's like, man, what, couldn't we make this like 15 minutes longer? You know,
wanted to see people like flayed alive and then set on fire. I hated these bullies so much.
So, but yeah, I dig it.
Awesome.
So all that right. was nice one to follow with the heartwarming animal picture.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. For
Sean's
me.
Sean's disturbed, it sounds like.
No, I was trying to look something up here. So I recently got, I found out that, there's a movie called FUBAR. It's a Canadian film about these two
metal
Canadian
movie,
metalheads.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. The first one deals with our main character. It's directed by Michael Dowse. The main character, Dean, played by Paul Spence, finds out that he has testicular cancer. And the whole first one is kind of, you know, fake documentary. What do you call it? Mockumentary, I guess, about his kind of dealing with this testicular cancer journey. And then there's FUBAR 2 they're back, no longer dealing with the heavy subject of cancer. But he's playing up the part of, like, a cancer survivor and trying to, like, you know, have that one up his, you know, whatever his career would be. But, you know, he tries to make that work for him. But
don't they have like an oil thing in that one? It's an oil, like they have an oil patch.
I can't remember. I really can't remember. But
wait, the movie you just watched, you can't remember? What are you talking about?
No, I've seen these. I just got these on Blu-ray. I haven't watched FUBAR 2 in a while.
Oh,
but both
okay.
of these come in one set. In the FUBAR 2 set on the Blu-ray, you get FUBAR and FUBAR 2. They are, going to be doing a TV series, and I'm not sure exactly where to find it. But anyway, FUBAR
– it just debuted, like, yesterday.
Okay.
I think it's like – I think you could watch the first episode online. I haven't watched it yet. But I think it's like it premiered on like Canadian television.
Okay.
Well, but literally it was just like released like the past couple days.
These are fantastic, really funny. I don't know like if this is underseen. I don't know – you know, I'm not sure how popular this little series is. But I want to just recommend it because – this really makes me laugh, you know, and these two characters are, you know, Dean and Terry are just – oh, dog, get off.
Yeah, I think the first
dog's
film –
dog's biting through my headphones.
Yeah, I think the first film was semi, like, kind of a cult favorite.
Yeah.
When the second one came out, I don't think too many people paid attention. But, they're both – I've seen both movies, and it's been a while since I've seen them because one's, like, early 2000s, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, the first one is great. And that, like I said, you just saw, like, with this second one, I can't remember as much, but I remember more of the first one. The first one, you know, is the better one. But these characters are kind of what makes these films, especially Paul Spence as Dean. This guy had this little mustache, the long hair, they're into metal. They talk with Canadian... You know, the good old they make that Canadian accent work for sure for their characters. Dogs, Jesus Christ!
Just throw them outside the room.
Oh my God! I try, and then they come to the door, and then they scratch at the freaking door. My dogs are ridiculous. Anyway, give FUBAR a shot if you haven't seen it. I'm sure – I know it was streaming for a while, but this Blu-ray was pretty cheap, and it comes with both of them. And I'm curious if any of you have seen the series and you know where we can find it. I know it's on Canadian television. I'm hoping that we can find it here in the States. If anyone has any information on that, please let us know. But give these flicks a shot, especially the first one, the first FUBAR. Giver.
Yeah. Cool.
Givery.
Cool. Cool. All right, I guess I'll go. Let's see here. So John Leonetti has made some not so great films in his life. I know people liked Annabelle movies, but I still can't get into them because I don't know how hard it is to make a fucking scary movie about a doll. But I can't get into Annabelle films. He's a great cinematographer. John Leonetti's been like every film that you've probably like. I mean, you've watched a film that's shot by him for sure. He's been the DP on countless movies. He's got a great eye. But whenever he's in the director's chair, he just seems that he can't pull it off. He started with the most. This isn't one of the reasons why I hate him so much is because I was a big Mortal Kombat fan when I was little. So when the movie came out in like 95, I was like 11. I was fucking stoked. I was so excited. You know, the movie's whatever. It's there. It's fine. It's not bad. It's not great. But, you know, it's a serviceable, you know, movie, especially coming from kind of the video game aspect, video game and the movies. Mortal Kombat's at least one of the ones that, you know, at least stays true to the game. And it's a fun little movie. The sequel, however, is directed by John Leonetti, which is one of the worst things I think has ever been made. Like, Mortal Kombat Annihilation is fucking terrible. It's really fun to watch with people just because, like, when I saw it in theaters, I was like, oh, man, all these cool – like, at least he added characters into the show or the movie. Because it was just, you know, fucking barrage of fucking characters coming at you from the game. But only for some reason, they only lasted, like, on screen for, like, 5 seconds. And then they met their demise, which was just so silly. But anyways, so then he did a follow-up to a film that I'm a fan of, The Butterfly Effect. I found The Butterfly Effect a decent movie. He did the sequel to it, which is not very good. Then he got the job for Annabelle. Well, between Annabelle and Annabelle 2, he made this movie called Wolves at Your Door. So this is one of the more recent releases. Of course, like, this came out like on VOD right before Annabelle 2 hit theaters, and I finally got around to it. I actually didn't know anything about it. I just knew that he made this movie called Wolves at Your Door. It's a home invasion movie. So I put it in, and at the start, and I was like, oh, shit, this is the fucking Sharon Tate murders. So he makes a film about that entire night about Sharon Tate and her friends that were attacked by, part of the Manson family. They were murdered that night. Pretty terrible thing that happened. But, it's not – I enjoyed the movie for what it was. For me personally, it's kind of hard to get into movies when I know what's going to happen. Like, you know, we're watching these characters fight through the night and it's like, you're going to die. You know, I don't know. There's a part of me, you know, it's like the Lincoln movie. You know what's going to fucking happen to Lincoln. You know, it's just like, you know, if you're going to take a story that's well known, as a filmmaker, a screenwriter, you need to make it interesting, or you need a Tarantino it like in Inglourious Basterds, where it's just like, wait, is Tarantino going to do what I think he's going to do? Holy shit, he's fucking doing it, and he changes fucking history. Like, that's pretty cool, you know, but I only think Tarantino could possibly get away with that. So Wolves at Your Door kind of it's a very nice aesthetic. You can feel that it's from the 70s. It looks good. It's very intense, which I enjoy. This is definitely by far his best film. But the only thing about it, it's not interesting. It's just a home invasion movie where the ending's spoiled for you. Mm-hmm. Like, then that's that. I think that's the thing where I was like watching. I was like, man, this is really good. But like, it's not any like twists or turns. It's not interesting visually. You know, we don't really have any interesting characters. We just have these characters that we, you know, we like, And then we just watch them meet their demise. But it's not a bad movie. And what really works, though, and I have to give John Leonetti some credit here, is he doesn't waste a second of screen time. I want to say this movie's clocked at 72 minutes, but the movie's only 63 minutes. Like, wow. It happens so quick, and that's what I really enjoyed. It's very fast-paced in that aspect. He doesn't linger on anything. He doesn't linger on characters to, like, give them hope. There's a couple things that happen in the movie where it's like, well, that's not what happened in real life, but at least it kind of keeps it interesting. It's nothing extreme to where it, like, you know, alters the history of what happened. But, you know, it's fine if you want a quick movie that's, you know, intense. And if you don't know the Manson murders too well, you know, it's and they also at the end, they have a lot of excerpts from Manson, what he said. And it makes the movie very haunting. They should have opened it with it, I think, because it would have made it more sinister. With this, I think they blew their load at the end, which they should have blew their load in the beginning, that type of thing. So. Anyways, yeah, watch it. It's definitely John Leonetti's best film. And, you know, like I said, visually, he doesn't do anything very interesting, but visually it has a nice aesthetic. Like, you really feel this movie's in the 70s. And I think that flows very well. Now I'm starting to think, did John Leonetti direct Annabelle 2?
Or no.
Was I shitting on Annabelle 2 for no reason?
Maybe. I've heard Annabelle Creation is actually pretty good. I want to watch it.
Guy that directed Lights Out.
David F. Sandberg, he directed Lights Out.
Yeah. All right, so
which I like the idea of Lights Out and the execution, but I didn't like that movie.
Yeah. Annabelle isn't good. So. Yeah, and that's the thing is, like, you know, at least in Annabelle – when they do, it's funny because they kind of do like a Manson thing too, which I thought was pretty interesting. Like the cult that is in the beginning of the film in Annabelle. You're familiar with the? No one's saying anything.
I fell asleep during the first Annabelle, so.
Oh,
thought it was boring.
Yeah, I know it's a very boring movie, but they have this very cultish Manson type thing going on, which I thought was pretty funny. Being that that's, you know, what he was doing afterwards. So I wonder if there's like any, you know, he was definitely thinking about both films at the same time, working with that. So anyways, but yeah, it's fine. It's a fine movie.
A quick question about it. Yeah. Because it's based on real people and a real event. Is it more from the victim's perspective or the Manson family or more of a third person?
No, it's definitely from – it's actually not – the star isn't Sharon Tate, the character. It's not – it's like she's in it, but – I mean obviously. But it's more focused on her friend that she invited over that night. So it kind of follows her because she like came to like LA to be an actress and it's not really working out. So she wants to go back home, but her boyfriend doesn't want her to. So it's mainly focused on that couple. And then, you know, Sharon Tate's just the one where the house is happening. She's fun. You know, she's bubbly. And then, most of the Manson family is like, they're really creepy. Every time the way they're lit, it's very dark and sinister looking. Whenever the actors and friends are on screen, it's very vibrant and bright. So it's a very unique kind of choice of lighting between the two. Like that's where I think Leonetti has a strong point. But yeah, the film's mainly focused on them. It's the Manson family is definitely the slashers, the stalkers in the film, which we don't get any information on them. They just show up and killing people. So
yeah, with like more biographical movies like you're talking about, one way I think filmmakers can kind of bring something new to it is like really pack in the empathy.
Yeah.
So I was just wondering if they were going that way.
And another thing, it wasn't exploitive too. Like that's another thing I think you have to be careful about. Cause if you're, you know, I'm really into true crime and stuff like that. So I really dive in and get into the sick stuff. So it's not dragged out like how the murders actually happened. They're very tame because I think they didn't want, you know, we're talking about a true crime here. That was a really terrible thing. I mean, a fucking Sharon Tate was like, you know, was due in like 2 weeks when she was murdered with her kid, you know, while, even though Polanski's a piece of shit, you know, Polanski was, couldn't make it that night. So if Roman Polanski was actually at that house that night, he would have, probably died. Which is kind of insane to think is, you know, kind of that, you know, as a person, like Polanski's like got to think about that. Like he wasn't able to like get it back home in time because I don't know if people, you know, listeners, but that was Polanski's wife that was murdered. So, yeah, that's kind of a heavy thing is like almost like a survivor's guilt, I think, in a way you could have like even though Polanski's a terrible person, we came to find out years later, is still kind of a heavy hitter. But it is another thing, they don't focus that on at all. They don't ever mention it, which I thought was pretty unique and a good move. So, but anyways, yeah, it gets a little dark. Sean, are you there?
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about a movie or? Steph wants to talk about a movie.
Is it Steph's turn?
It is, but if Brad wants to skip over me.
I know.
Oh, I guess we're laying the cards on the table.
Steph is after you, Brad.
Wow. Wow.
Son of a bitch. All right. Yeah. Stephanie, what do you got?
Oh, so sorry.
I will go to the Criterion Collection.
Oh.
Yeah, I have my pinky up.
Hold on. Let me grab a Perrier.
Okay, yes. Is this the flavored one?
Of course.
Okay, good.
No, you would.
We're at the time of the year where Barnes & Noble's doing one of their 50% off sales, and Criterion just did another flash one. That's pretty much the only time I buy them. I mean, I love them, but, you know. So I picked up The Lure, which I heard some good and interesting things about, but I didn't actually know much about it. But as I was reading about it, the musical aspect, a horror aspect, and mermaids, I don't know what my alley looks like, but that's up it.
That's totally turns my head as well.
Yes, it's a Polish film. And it's set in the 1980s, and there are these two girls, and they're kind of brought into kind of a burlesque strip club that is interesting and gimmicky, and they have, like, lounge singers. And we find out that they're mermaids, and everyone's like, wow, mermaids, but it's more like, oh, wow, someone has an extra toe rather than holy shit, mermaids exist. So right away, it sets a tone that we're kind of totally in an alternate reality. And I kind of hate talking about movies like this because I could list out a lot of unusual things that happen in it. And I don't want to take away from the impact of the film because they sound kind of bonkers by themselves. And I don't want to sound like they've just been like throwing spaghetti at the wall. It's very unusual, but it's a beautiful film. It kind of just floats into whatever genre it feels like. The musical aspect, it's, I don't know. It almost made me kind of think of The Fan in the way, even though they're actually singing, it just felt very organic. I just made a mermaid swimming motion with my arms when I said organic.
I saw it. By the way. I felt the aura good of a mermaid swimming just now.
Yeah. No, it's a beautiful film. The actors are wonderful. You could call the mermaid thing a gimmick. You could call the musical aspect a gimmick, but the characters are very well drawn out. I loved all the relationships is very complex. There was a fairy tale aspect well, a very strong fairy tale aspect, but I like it when they kind of like magical realism, when they kind of bring that into the everyday. How would a fairy tale play out, you know, in a workplace, let's say? This was wonderful. I love it when I get a blind buy like this and it really works out. So I would recommend it if you're very open-minded. And I don't mean that in a snooty way. I mean, it's a journey. And there's a lot of dreamlike aspects. Not everything's explained. It follows more with the heart than the head. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. And it's gorgeous and it's completely original. So that was a very happy purchase.
Awesome. I completely agree with you. If Steph, you need to... Let me see if this movie's available. If you like Delora, you're going to love... let's see. It's called Liza, the Fox Fairy.
Okay.
And it's a... I can't remember what country it's from. It's one of those things that it's not... don't think it's ever been released over here, but you can get it, like, on DVD, and it has English subs. But it's very... it's very lore-ish, like, as far as, like, kind of the tone and the comedic aspect of the film. But, yeah, I think the lore is definitely an audience pleaser, no matter what genre of movies that you love and that's your thing. Even if you hate horror, don't like musicals, I still think the lore has something that everybody can enjoy.
See, someone mentioned they were at a film festival that was screening it, and people actually walked out. And after watching that, that really surprised me, because I kind of had, you know, I try to watch a movie with a very clear mind. But in the back of my head, I'm like, okay, I'm waiting for a part where I think people may walk out. And I mean, especially looking at the poster, I kind of couldn't figure it out.
Yeah, it played a fantastic fest, and it was extremely well received there. So, yeah, I don't understand what group of people would walk out. Like, but that's like that is the definition of fantastic fest. So it is a film like Delora that is everything fantastic fest in a nutshell. So, but anyways, yeah, I suggest you check it out too. It's a good release. Kind of interesting that Criterion picked it up too. I thought that was a smooth move. Their contemporary films they pick up, I think they do a very, very good job of combing through those. So, because they also released Personal Shopper in October, and I thought that was a, you know, that movie is my total jam. That's everything. So,
and this has two short films by the director too.
Directed by a woman too.
Yep,
which is awesome. Yeah. So,
I'm not going to insult her by trying to pronounce her name though.
Yeah, that's. I let Sean do that.
Yeah.
No, it's okay.
I'll step on toes.
So, what you got, Sean?
All right, I got your favorite movie of the year to talk about, Brad. Matt Reeves has taken the reins of from Rise of the Planet of the Apes. So I'm going to talk about War for the Planet of the Apes. And I absolutely loved it. I love what Matt Reeves has done with the series. The first one, Rise for the Planet of the Apes, was directed by... Oh, God, I can't remember.
It's the guy that directed The Escapist.
Yeah.
It's the guy that directed The Escapist. I can't think of his name. It's
Rupert Wyatt.
Yeah.
So Matt Reeves took the director reins for the next one, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, and now War for Planet of the Apes. And, like, I never thought that I would feel, like, empathy for CG, you know, creatures and like the artistry that's going in to first kind of go on this journey with Caesar played or motion captured, I guess, by Andy Serkis. And you really kind of go on this journey. Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, I feel like, is a strong film in its own right, where you kind of get to know his motivations on wanting to kind of lead these apes and you know, to freedom and everything. So then you get to War from Planet of the Apes, which is it's a war film, but they also bring in kind of the prison escape film. And
that movie is a fucking prison escape film all the way through. There's no fucking war. There's no war in War of Planet of the Apes.
Which is fine. Like it opens up with a pretty fantastic battle scene. You kind of see like these other apes have joined up with the humans to kind of be there. They call them their donkeys. That world building alone of like the humans are kind of on the last stand. They know that possibly they're gonna become extinct. There's this virus that is, you know, taking away their speech and everything else. They meet another ape along the way who's like he's from a zoo, voiced and performed, captured by Steve Zahn, which is a pretty great blend of comic relief, but also like there's some empathy there, like with his character.
And then worst there's this character ever.
Little jeez, and then the little girl. I don't know who Nova, played by Amaya Miller, and I think she does a great job because she doesn't speak through the whole film, and she emotes a lot through her eyes. So I thought this movie was great. I was happy that it wasn't a full-on just war movie. I liked the journey aspect of it. I liked the prison escape parts of this film. So I thought, you know, as a trilogy, I think that this works. If it goes past here, which I feel like they're going to do, I don't know if they can continue kind of this emotional journey. It's going to get more science fiction-y and, you know, it'll go to different places. But I can't believe that this film was even made. You know, these films were made in kind of like Matt Reeves.
Me either.
Matt Reeves kind of got to do what he wanted to do. The soundtrack or the score is just incredible. I'm having a brain blank on his name, Giacchino.
I don't know the name.
He did the Rogue One score. He did Up. He did Michael Giacchino. He's a really good composer. So the third film, like I feel like these are three very strong films. I think that it takes this journey of Caesar through to a satisfying end. The artistry of the motion capture, the digital effects, me actually connecting with these apes. I thought it was a really well done film, and I think it's a strong entry in the series. And I adored it. It's probably one of my top films of the year.
Oh my god!
Yeah. So, Brad, what didn't you like about War for the Planet of the Apes?
Yes, it out.
Let me preface that by saying that Rise of the Planet of the Apes, I do not like any of the Planet of the Apes films at all, other than Rise and Dawn. Like everything before then, I can't get into them. I don't think they're very good. I haven't attempted all the old films, but I've seen like two of them. I've seen fucking Tim Burton's awful piece of shit.
And have you seen Stop the Planet of the Apes, I Want to Get Off, the musical?
I would love to. So
that sounds amazing.
It's The Simpsons.
When Rise came out, I was very apprehensive about it just because I'm not into those. But after seeing Rise, I thought Rise was one of the best movies I saw that year. I listed it in my top 10 for like Pop Shifter or whatever I was doing at the time. I thought it was absolutely amazing. So I was really excited about Dawn, and Dawn came out, and I thought that was another film that hit my top 10 in 2014. So I was very, very pumped about War of the Planet of the Apes. War of the Planet of the Apes, I feel it's just a clusterfuck. It doesn't know where it wants to go. It has no direction whatsoever.
Did you fall asleep during it? I think
no,
I fell asleep during it.
No, I was in the theater. I was wanting so much out of it because we follow, you know, Maurice, we follow Rocket, we follow Caesar, you know, these emotional characters through these apes, you know, that we connect with, we feel, you know, sympathy for. They deserve more than this as far as storytelling. It's this really like goofy, like prison breakout movie with this awful new ape played by Steve Zahn, who's like one of the worst people in the world to begin with. So like we have
this man
that takes away everything from the film. He has maybe one laugh, but like it took out the energy of the film because of the comic relief. We don't have any comic relief pretty much in the first and second film, other than maybe like funny things that might happen, like ironic stuff. But
well, I think they had to, because Caesar is like so hardened and so like he has no.
But that's what makes the movie. That's what gives it the drive. We're watching a race, you know, at this point, like a different race of apes.
Yeah.
You know, realize that, you know, they're being imprisoned, that they're being, you know, tortured, and Caesar is able to communicate, and he creates a wonderful relationship with a human, and is able to be a teacher and has this amazing bond with these characters. And we have so many great characters as apes. But they deserve more. You know, Woody Harrelson is fine. He's a great villain in the film, but everything like it, for the beginning of the film's fine. But once it kind of just it goes into I don't want to be spoiled. I can't really do any spoilers because the film's newer. Mm-hmm. But once Winter is exposed, the one ape, mm-hmm. and you find out what's happening with Winter and all of that. Once it actually goes into what happens with Caesar, that's when the film falls apart, because you're thinking, holy shit, having Caesar just deal with all of this, and then it just amounts to basically nothing as far as the story's told. You know, I mean, Caesar gets what he needs, but I just feel that we've carried this journey with these apes, and it's just – as far as like a screenwriting and director's perspective, you just kind of shit on these characters, and you didn't give them redemption. You didn't give them what they've actually fought for. Not that that's always deserved in film. You know, not everybody gets what they want, but it's so hard without spoiling the film, with the outcome of these characters, like, during the finale, you know, with Rocket, with Maurice, you know, with, you know, the images of what's, you know, haunting, Caesar being haunted by Koba, mm-hmm. all of this stuff, it just amounts to basically nothing for them. And there's something there. That's what I get pissed off about. I was like, wait, no, there is that redemption. There is that, but they just don't show it. And there's just it has all this momentum build up for these first two films, and this film just falls flat on its fucking face.
Wow. I disagree.
And I don't – I'm not saying it's a bad film. I'm not saying it's a bad movie. I'm saying as far as like carrying this film on, you know, the shoulders of these apes for the first two films, this film is just complete fucking bore fest. Like, and the people, and the thing was, is that I was in the theater, I was with some friends, and I was with Willow, and I just kept my mouth shut. I was like, I know what's going to happen is that they're going to turn to me and Brad, what did you think of this? And I was quickly relieved by at least three people that we were with said, nope, that movie sucked. And I was like, oh my God, okay, so I'm not the only one. So, yeah, it's not very good.
Well, Brad, would you say that you hate every ape you see from chimpan A to chimpan Z?
Wow. That is some
stuff for the jokes.
Right there. That's from the musical, people. Learn yourself. Join the choir.
All right. Well, if you're a fan of War from the Planet of the Apes, there's some pretty great special features on here about the making of the score. It's great to see Matt Reeves, his enthusiasm and passion for these films. There's a pretty great audio commentary. I dug into everything, all the special features of this. I ate this thing up. I love it so much. And for me, it's probably one of the most perfect trilogies I've seen in a long time. So, all right.
Save that for The Dark Knight.
Oh, God.
Merchandising idea. Everybody see the movie, and then you can get a Team Sean or a Team Brad pin with a monkey on it. Think about it.
There you go. All right, Brad, what do you got?
All right, let's see here. I picked up I wanted to talk about this movie again since we're talking about, you know, that Criterion sale that fucking broke me. So I picked up too many DVDs, Blu-rays, but I got around to watching a couple. I wanted to rewatch this one because it's very short. I saw this at South by Southwest, and I just wasn't prepared for it. It's the documentary about David Lynch called The Art Life. I enjoyed it a lot more the second time around just because I thought we were going to see a documentary about David Lynch, which we do. However, David Lynch is technically directing this documentary himself. You can tell he is. David Lynch, I think, is the only person that can get away with saying, hey, look at me. This is what I've done. I'm David Lynch. I can do what I want. And it'd be funny and not pretentious. That's the thing with David Lynch I can love about him, because certain directors, certain filmmakers, there is this pretentious side to them where it's just like, ugh, you know, you're full of yourself. Be quiet. Just make movies. But David Lynch embraces his weirdness, and that's what I love about him. He knows that he knows what he's doing. He knows that he is weird. He likes weird shit. If you don't like it, he doesn't really care. He's not out to be successful. He's out to do what he loves. That is his weird movies, his weird paintings, and that's kind of what this documentary follows. It's basically him and his life now, having a little kid, being a painter, smoking and drinking coffee, and just kind of doing whatever he wants. I mean, he's did the Twin Peaks, revival. And then one of the best David Lynch moments is one of his dear friends through life was Harry Dean Stanton, who passed away earlier this year. Harry Dean Stanton has a movie coming out very soon, and I suggest you all watch it, called Lucky. David Lynch plays Harry Dean Stanton's best friend in the film, and it is just great, because it's really David Lynch playing himself with his best friends, it's just a beautiful movie with Harry Dean Stanton. But anyways, the Art Life focuses, like I said, on Lynch and his weirdness, and I really, really dug it because I don't know. It's just one of those things where you have to watch, because, like I said, he's so good at what he does as far as art goes, that he can kind of do whatever he wants. I know that's very repetitive what I just said, but and also with his son, which I actually skipped over that. The director of Lucky is actually David Lynch's son, which I thought was pretty funny. Pick it up. If it tells you anything, a quote from the film, David Lynch went to go see Bob Dylan. And in the documentary, he's talking about it. And he said he didn't like Bob Dylan's music. And he got up and he walked out of the concert. And his friend said, "You can't walk out on Dylan." And he says, "I can fucking walk out on Dylan." And he exits. And that sums up David Lynch for anybody, if you're unfamiliar with his work. That's just the type of person he is. And watching this a second time, knowing what I'm getting into, because I thought we're going to watch, you know, a documentary about David Lynch from the time he was little till he's older, which you do get. But it's very invasive with Lynch controlling what you see and you hear, and David Lynch just loving himself. So yeah, I suggested it's one of the cheaper Criterion titles, just because it's produced by Janus Films, I believe. So that's the reason why it's on the label. Not too many times you get documentaries from Criterion. But when they do release them, like something like George Washington or, a camera person, there's a lot going on with the docs. And I think there's a lot going on with this one. So any fan of Lynch, or even if you like one of his movies, I think you'll really like the documentary. So
that's awesome. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah,
I agree with you. Like, in the least, he's a true artist. I mean that in the least pretentious way possible. Like, there are filmmakers who I think are just brilliant, but he's one of the few that his point of view and his control is so strong that I think he literally can't function any other way. It's just pure art. Like, even from things that kind of piss people off, like not allowing chapter stops for his films on a lot of his discs. Even like little things like that. I'll definitely have to check that out.
Yeah. And you don't question David Lynch, is that that's the other thing I like about it. And it is, like I said, he's the only person to get away with this like pretentious persona, but it doesn't affect anything. Like I laugh at it. It's like the uncle that's the worst uncle ever, but it's just uncle that he can get away with what he's doing because that's just him. That's all David Lynch is, I think. He just does whatever he wants and get away with whatever he wants. And it's just, oh, that's just David Lynch. This is how he is. It's totally cool.
He's not an asshole.
That's the other thing. He's not.
I've never heard that about him.
Yeah, that's what works. I mean, I don't know behind the scenes, like if someone would argue with him, hey, let's do this instead. But I don't think anybody would, because if you had the opportunity to work with Lynch, you know, I don't think any editor for Inland Empire said, hey, maybe we should make this not 4 hours long. You know, it was like, David Lynch wants this every second in this movie. Let's fucking do it, you know? So, anyways. All right, Sean. Or Steph.
Wow. What a bastard.
I am a terrible, terrible person.
You get to talk about a movie you hate, then you get to talk about David Lynch. Okay.
Yeah. I can't wait to hear what you talk about. What do you have, Steph, so I can not shit on it?
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll take David Lynch torch, run it to Kyle MacLachlan, and with The Hidden.
Okay. Ooh, yeah.
Highly anticipated. The Warner Archive finally released it to a lot of excitement. And it's not super packed, but it does have a commentary. And I was always ashamed because this was one, like a lot of films I would read about in Fangoria and kind of imagine in my mind. And then I think I saw 35 minutes of it on Cinemax or HBO at one point. And I never followed through on it. I felt terrible about it. So I pre-ordered this. I got it right away. And I'm pretty sure everyone listening to this knows that it completely lives up to its reputation. It's absolutely wonderful. It has everything. You have your gore, but you have your buddy cop and you have your sci-fi.
Some metal.
Yes. And a possessed dog. You got everything, man. It's great.
Yeah, it's one of those movies that really has a lot of charm to it as far as like a horror film goes. And a lot of times you don't get that with horror sci-fi, but it's very charming with the two characters between Nori and MacLachlan just kind of working off one another. There's some great buddy cop moments in there. And it's got just a great soundtrack. It's got great one-liners. It's one of the one movies that my mom still quotes. My mom quotes the movie all the time, and she'll do it too, like whenever we're hanging out, or it's like, because she'll come over and watch movies with me every once in a while, like if we're both off work. She'll come over and we'll watch like two or three movies, and like we'll go get pizza, and like she'll just look and she'll go, "Give me the keys." And that's her. That's her. Working off one of the one-liners in there from The Hidden. So yeah, it was one of the very first movies I remember, like my mom like just adoring. Like she fucking loves this movie so much. which is pretty badass. So anyways, yeah, I agree with you. I was really happy to see it because I had that DVD for so long. And then, you know, a movie that gets shit on a lot is The Hidden Two. And I always liked The Hidden Two. But yeah, a lot of people just don't know because it's one of those movies that just kind of got released. It came out, you know, like probably about 5-6 years later. And then it hit VHS and I think it might be on DVD, but it kind of got lost in the mix. But, yeah. So is that your first time watching it, like in its entirety from the Blu-ray disc?
Yeah, truly watching it, yeah.
Oh, man, I envy you so much.
Wow.
I don't know, because you have your cool pizza mom quoting stories, and I want her to have a sticker on the front of movies like this instead of those stupid Rotten Tomatoes ones. Brad's mom approved.
Yeah. So yeah, it's and the cool thing was is I actually I watched it with Willow not that long ago, before the Blu-ray came out or whatever. And I told Willow, I was like, hey, this is one of Grandma's like favorite movies, and she knows that Grandma's pretty wild at times. So she's watching it, and it was so amazing because within like 15 minutes. Willow turns to me and she goes, oh, he's an alien. And I was like, wait, what? Like, how the fuck did you pick that up? I mean, there are like hints all through, like little subtle hints. But I just remember, like, you know, even watching the movie again and again, I would kind of tend to forget that. But, you know, Willow picked up on it, like, and she goes, oh, because he said this and this, he's got to be an alien. And I was like, wow, that's pretty cool that you could pick that up. I mean, yeah, Willow's smart and she's 12. But, you know, for something that was, you know, kind of no pun intended, hidden as far as a thing in the film, you know, Willow kind of blew me away with picking that up. Because even as an adult, I'd probably watch it and not pick it up. So anyways. I'm
glad she's there with you for the coming invasion. Because it is coming.
So yeah, watch The Hidden Two though, Steph. It's I think you would.
I will.
In fact, you gotta get a kick out of it. And I think one of the like the lead character's name is McLaughlin, which I thought.
Oh, McLaughlin.
Yeah,
that's cute.
Yeah, they just did it to the whole movie is like homage to the first film, so you could really tell.
That She Wolf of London is in it. I'm seeing it.
Who is it?
Kate Hodge.
Oh yeah,
yeah, she was in London. That show is amazing.
Yeah,
I'm definitely gonna see it.
Yeah, she was in Leatherface too, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3, I think.
Yeah, the third one. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, fun little movie. So.
It's confusing when you say Leatherface 2. Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3. Sorry. Hey, Sean, start talking.
Yeah. No, it's fine. We probably won't talk too long about this one either. But curiosity, especially with shark movies, always gets the best of me. And I knew going in that 47 Meters Down was probably not a good movie. But I am a sucker for shark movies. I will pretty much give everyone a shot if I can. This is directed by Johannes Roberts, who says he is a scuba enthusiast, but he gets pretty much everything wrong about scuba diving in this film about scuba diving.
Man, fucking Sean's throwing shade at the director.
Yeah, because the whole premise of this film is these two sisters – get trapped at the 47 meters down at the bottom of the ocean, in a shark cage. They are supposed to be dialoguing with each other through the entire film, in these special masks that are supposedly have radio frequency. That's how they communicate. However, there is nothing covering their ears at all through the entire film. Like, there's no way they could hear each other. Like, at all. Like, then there's no explanation how they can communicate. They're even their voices echo like through caves. Like it'll show them at the bottom of the ocean, and they're talking, and you hear an echo. It's so stupid.
I like when Sean doesn't like something.
But this is like, other than that, like this is a pretty serviceable kind of shark film. Like they're not in it that much, but it's, you know, stuck at the bottom. Like, oh yeah. And decompression, like there's no way, like if you really went down that fast, 47 meters down to the bottom, your basically ears would explode and your eyeballs would probably explode from the pressure. They're fine, but a watch doesn't make it.
I just looked up the director's other work, and everything you're saying makes sense. Because
someone gave him a lot of money, and they must not have seen his other films.
I dislike a lot of this guy's film.
Like what?
Storage 24.
A lot of numbers. I don't like it. I'm with you.
Storage 24. Roadkill, which has the Stephen Ray from it. But yeah, it's this weird like Irish like monster movie. It's so bad. And then I have this on Blu-ray. It's called F, but when it was released in the U.S., it was called The Expelled. It was trying to be like a slasher, and it's just it's just not good. I've seen some of his other movies too. The Other Side of the Door was his big movie last year that was popular. So
yeah, I mean. It's this movie's it's like the fact that they get these like things so wrong, like is so distracting, because if they would have, like, I'm just thinking to myself, like, all right, if they would have put something over their ears, like in the Avengers, like they obviously have nothing in their ears, but they touch their ears, like, oh, maybe there's something inside their ear when they're all talking and flying around, like somehow they can communicate. Like you'll see Captain America put his hand to his ear, and you're like, oh, he has a comm. Like, there's nothing in this explaining that at all. So if they would have just put, like, a cheap plastic thing over maybe one ear, I don't know.
Like, are you excited about 48 meters
down? Oh, man, you don't even know.
Totally. I like it when he's mad, too.
No, that's actually – that's really happening. Like, they're making
making a sequel. This made a lot of money. And
you know what's crazy about it, though? Do you know the history of the release of this movie? Were you aware of that? So this movie got DVD release like late 2016, 2017, and it hit shelves. And then a week later, it was pulled, and they made a theatrical release out of it. So this movie, like, it was out there on DVD. Like, it was DVD only. And people bought it. People watched it. I bought it. I had it, and I watched it. And I just
wow! I didn't know that.
Yeah, it hit DVD release, and then I turned around and sold my DVD. It's going for like.
I thought that was The Shallows.
No, this is 47 meters down.
Oh, okay.
I made like $100 off the DVD. It was great.
That's awesome.
I sold it after. I was like, oh shit, this movie is not very good.
Anyway, I thought I would talk about 47 meters down. But if they would have fixed a few technical things like that, it would be just kind of a B shark movie. I would can kind of just settle back and be entertained, you know. But
Andy Moore's in it. I couldn't complain.
What's that?
So Andy Moore was in it, so I didn't complain.
Oh, okay.
So
I mean, everyone's trying so hard, but like nobody went to the director and went, "Hey, how is everyone? How are they communicating with everybody?"
Yeah.
Like, there's a microphone in the mask that you see, but there's no way they could hear anything because they would just hear water. All they would hear would be, like, that's all they would hear.
Really, really good. That's really good.
Yeah.
And then there's a weird twist at the end, which they could have left out because the fake ending is fantastic. And then there's a stupid twist. So
I don't remember this movie at all, actually, now that we're talking about it.
Yeah. Whatever.
I'm looking at the release dates.
All right, Brad, what you got?
Oh, I didn't know I was going.
I'll skip you and then go to Stephanie. How's that?
So I watch here, let me pick something good. I have a lot of stuff.
I know.
So I watched this company releases some interesting films. But I watched this is The Night of the Scorpion. So this company is Dorado Films. They do legit releases. Everything's pressed. They have, you know, little booklets with their films. But it's one of those companies that you can only get it through their website, kind of like Code Red and everything like that.
Aren't they doing some stuff with Mondo Macabre right now?
They are?
Well, I thought they had like a little releasing deal, but I'm not sure.
Oh,
that now would be... that you don't know about it, I'm second guessing it.
Well, no, I don't know everything. This is All Region Disc, which is pretty cool. But this company has existed for a little bit. They've done a lot of like DVDs, and you know, I have a couple of their westerns and stuff like that. So they had The Night of the Scorpion is the movie I'm trying to talk about here, but I keep on getting sidetracked because I was trying to look at the. Yeah, so this is All Region. This was released this year. It's an interesting movie, and you know, it looks like with this film they found the best print they could, and they released it from that. Which it's pretty, you know, banged up and stuff like that, but it's kind of a giallo-esque spin. It's more on the sexy, slow thriller side rather than, you know, kind of the murderous side. It's it's really odd. It's just oddly paced, but then once our killer kind of shows up, then it picks up a tiny bit and does kind of the more giallo-esque thing, but it takes a little while to get there. But, you know, I was pleasantly surprised with it because, like I said, it's, you know, it's one of those companies that's kind of comes out of nowhere, but, you know, they have decent transfer of their – of the print that they had, because I've never heard of this movie before they released it. I skipped over it, and apparently it's in Troy Howarth's giallo book, So Deadly, So Perverse, which I guess I skimmed over it, or it just didn't stand out for me. But yeah, it's a fun, slow giallo. So if you have the extra dough, and if you're kind of a giallo completionist, I suggest picking it up. But yeah, it's a pressed. I know with a lot of these smaller companies that aren't on Amazon, that have high priced Blu-rays, because it is more on the expensive side unless they're doing a sale. But I mean, it's a legit. It has a booklet. It has a pressed disc. It's all regions. So they definitely have their shit together. So pick it up. If you are a fan, they also have some other cool like westerns, and I think they have a Jess Franco collection, which I picked up too, that I will talk about soon enough. So
nice.
Highly suggested for people that like that type of shit, for sure. Like, it's totally up people's alleys if they're really into kind of giallos that's not Fox with the Velvet Tail. So it's very reminiscent to the kind of that storytelling, okay. But there's actually a killer involved, you know.
Upside down kissing.
No upside down kissing, but there's some weird relationship stuff. That's why I was going kind of slow, because I didn't want to be too spoilery about that. So I was like stumbling over my words, and I was like, okay, maybe I should talk about the plot, about the weird, like, sexy thing that's happening, but. Just leave that to your imagination and get ready, because I don't want to be too spoilery, because it's one of those films that I guarantee you, like, only maybe 0% of our listeners have actually seen. It's like, because I was looking up the history, it's super rare.
Okay.
So, you know, it's probably one of those films that somebody in the company saw. It was like, wow, no one else is going to go after this shit. So
cool.
Because I think it's a lost film, so.
Okay. Hey, Stephanie, what was the film you mentioned after Brad talking about the David Lynch doc? I'm trying to keep a list, and I did not jot it down. And
The Hidden?
The Hidden. That's right. Okay. Duh.
I said it hide from you, Sean.
Good Lord. It'll be okay. We'll get through this together.
Why didn't you laugh at Steph's joke? I thought it was hilarious.
Oh, don't give me a pity laugh. That's worse.
I missed it. Because it went over my head. Probably. It went over my head.
It's okay.
Well, I almost asked Brad if he's seen Dial M for Murderousness, but I think I've done enough Troy McClure quotes in this episode. Okay, so do I get to go?
Yes.
Do I get to talk? Yes. Okay. I watched this last night. This is another one that kind of This is another blind buy. It's from Kino. I've been having a little too much fun with their sales. Has anyone seen Heart of Midnight?
Heart of Midnight?
Not yet. I feel like I bought it and haven't watched it yet.
Okay. It stars Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Oh my God, Jennifer Jason Leigh. Bone Town.
Yeah.
Sorry.
1989 Jennifer Jason Leigh. Peter Coyote, Frank Stallone pops up, didn't see that coming, and a really early Steve Buscemi role.
Yeah.
This is a very strange film. Jennifer Jason Leigh's character, she has an uncle. He owned a really crazy whorehouse. He died and left it to her. She wants to turn into kind of a classy cabaret nightclub. And she runs into trouble with the dudes who are working there. They don't take her seriously. And she gets sexually assaulted. And because she has a history with mental health, she's not taken seriously. This is where Frank Stallone comes in. And, you know, it starts out, you kind of think it's going to be one of those like late 80s, early 90s kind of you know, late night adult thrillers. But then when it takes the turn at sexual violence, you're like, okay. And then it gets very nightmarish, very strange, really patchwork, kind of going into the mind of an unreliable narrator. We don't know who to trust. And it just gets darker and darker and darker. And it's just... At the end of it, I'm glad I saw it because it's very original. But wow, if I could personify a movie, this one is just careening into different hotel rooms, and there's something fucked up going up and going on every single room. It's like, oh, okay, I'll grab something from here. Oh, okay, over here. Jennifer Jason Leigh is great in it. It's a really complex, weird role they gave her, and she's wonderful. Yeah, it's a corker. Make sure you're kind of prepared for it if you do end up watching it.
She is in some hard to swallow films. Like, she always ends up, especially around that time, I feel like she ended up in some like really good films, but then she took on some like really hard to swallow subjects and I don't know, just really darker and weird. Like she was always kind of, which end up in those. And she was of course one of those actresses I always would want to, you know, see her films. So yeah.
You want to hear something really fucked up?
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen this movie since I was like eight.
Oh boy.
Yeah. So yeah, here's the story behind that fun little story. So when Steph mentioned it, the title didn't ring a bell, but I looked up and I saw the poster. So every once in a while, you know, I would see these like, you know, kind of sexy covers when I was younger at the video store. And, you know, I couldn't rent them because my mom went to the video store with me and, you know, she wanted to rent horror and stuff like that. Is everybody still there?
Yeah, so yep. No Jennifer Jason Leigh in a latex dress smoking.
Oh, it like was super like dangerously quiet there for a second. So
have you ever seen Dangerously Quiet?
So I would see these covers, like the cover to Two Moon Junction, yeah, to After Dark, My Sweet, to Heart of Midnight, to the movie called Horror. Like, I would see those covers and be like, oh man, I want to rent that movie so bad. It's got probably boobs in it and stuff. So when we would go to Ohio, my parents and my grandmothers would go to bingo, like all-night bingo escapades, and not get back till 2 a.m. So my grandpa would take me to the video store. So I would track down these movies and rent them with him, because he didn't ever look at the covers or anything. He was old and he didn't really give a shit, and he's out of his mind. So I could rent some of these movies and watch them, and that's one of the movies that I watched when I was very, very young. It probably explains a lot.
Yeah, that
I think it does.
I'm old, and it was a little intense for me.
Yeah, so I remember watching, like, I remember the night I watched Horror, and I was like, oh my God. I can't even believe they actually got away with calling a movie called Horror, but anyways, it's...
I thought you were saying horror. But no, you were saying whore. Okay.
Yeah. W-H-O-R-E.
Yeah, I think Teresa Russell's in it. Because she's in The Hidden, right? Or is that the – no, that's the girl that looks like Teresa Russell.
Do you guys want to hear Roger Ebert's review of Heart of Midnight?
Yeah.
This is March 3rd, 1989. He gave it 2.5 stars. So he says, Heart of Midnight is a horror film that descends into the depths of bizarre sexual behavior for no better reason than to see what it will find there. It finds a lot.
Wow.
So that's what I love about and we need to get back to this. Like, it's a 2-paragraph review. And, like, everyone thinks they need to, like, write these big, long reviews of these films and everything. Like, we need to take some lessons from Roger Ebert.
Just two lines. Boom. Two lines can get me to watch a movie. Just it needs to be the right lines.
Yeah.
So.
You're good at brevity, I'll always go for it.
Very nice. Anything else about Heart of Midnight?
I was doing something right after the movie, so I turned the commentary on for like 10 minutes. And the little I heard was the director apologizing for his choices, mainly like, oh, this is kind of obvious, and Peter Coyote saying, yeah, this is pretty obvious, man. So I feel like it's a good commentary from the little I heard.
I love it when commentaries get, like, they're just, you know, totally candid about everything. I love it. And they don't really care to gloss over things. All right. I got around to finally watching The Unholy.
Oh.
I saw your tweet about that.
Now, as my tweet said, please, more religious fantasy horror all the time, please. Like, that's what I love the most out of this film, because it's a priest who's kind of battling his own inner demons a little bit. Of course, every movie that has a priest, he's kind of battling his own demons with his faith, because, you know, they're repressed. They, give up having sex, and that's always a big deal. But this was directed by Camilo Vela, starring Ruben Rabassa as Father Dennis. There's some other character actors that show up in this that I can't find their names right now. I'm not – oh, Ned
Hal Davies. Holbrook.
Hal Holbrook, yes. It's pretty great. The creature effects towards the end are inspired. Like, you know, they tried really hard to do it.
I always love a question mark at the end of that.
You know that they are inspired by, like, Queen Alien, you know, you need a big monster. And I watched some of the special features, and it turns out that's exactly what happened. The special effects guy, I can't remember his name right now, but he was inspired a lot by, you know, The Howling and Rick Baker and all these guys. And he kind of, you know, said he can do everything, but he was more experienced in makeup. But he got the gig, and he was kind of being – there was a bigger budget horror film. Like, the studio was giving him a lot of money for the special effects, but they didn't really know what they were doing. So I wonder what it would be like in the hands of a more experienced, you know, special effects and puppeteer and, you know, what we would see, you know. But it's pretty funny once you get to that aspect of the film. But I, you know, this movie has like atmosphere and spades. Like, I love the practical effects, you know, of just like a ground covered in fog, that the church, like the ground is all covered in fog inside the church. And it just looks really cool. Like, there's a lot of stuff you'd see today that would just be CG, but there's, you know, there's just that, you know, extra level of knowing that it's practical. But, this movie has a lot of atmosphere. It gets balls to the wall, crazy, batshit crazy in the end, which is always my cup of tea with these films. But I really, really enjoyed it. Who is the guy that plays the strip, like the satanic strip club owner? Doesn't he wake up in like a bed with like, there's a few just, my daughter just walked in, so now I got to censor myself. Dear God Almighty. See? Anyway, he's pretty great. The whole, like, you know, satanic strip club is just beautifully realized, exactly what you would think it would be. This movie's a lot of fun. I can tell they used an HD Master. I was hoping it would look a little better. But I totally saw, Brad, what you always bring up with these Vestron videos. I saw it here. And,
well,
yeah, I wish it would look a little better. But
I don't mean to shit on your parade.
Oh, man. Okay.
But I think The Unholy was actually a scan of the Interpositive.
Oh, really?
Hmm. Yeah.
Okay. It looked okay, but it didn't.
It looks okay. But I'll say for anybody that is really looking into The Unholy, like, it's fine, but it's totally worth it for the last 20 minutes.
Oh, man.
Like, don't make me buy Vestron.
My sexual orientation is basically the last 15 minutes of The Unholy. What it's like for a night in the bedroom with me is the last 15 minutes of The Unholy. If you want to know, man, what was Brad like as a lover?
A lot of tongue. A lot of big, disgusting tongue, apparently.
The last 15 minutes is definitely a sexy night with Brad Henderson. So.
That's fantastic.
I really don't like The Unholy, but the last like 15, 20 minutes of that movie are absolutely amazing.
They're in it win it, man. Just put this on like, screen.
I feel like as filmmakers, they filmed it in sequence. Yeah. And then at the end, they were like, wait a second, we haven't done anything in this entire movie. And they're like, how much money do we have left over? About $20 million. What should we do with it? Let's just pour it all into just crazy fucking shit. And that's what they did. I mean, as obvious.
I need it.
Doctors, but it was, I can't, like, I sweat at the end of that movie because I'm like, oh my God. I was like, this was insane. Why didn't they make the whole movie like this? It could have been so upbeat and fun.
Oh, but the beginning's pretty awesome, though, when the guy gets his like throat ripped out or whatever. I mean, its moments for sure.
You didn't even talk about how it's, people are killing priests and stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's like a serial killer of killing these priests, and yeah, the kills are fine, but you have no idea that movie is going into that direction for the last 15 minutes. Like, you can't even spoil it if you explained it. Like, you have to see it.
I like that.
I can give you a play-by-play of the last 15 minutes, and you still are like, wait a second, what? Like, that actually happens? So, yeah, it's totally worth it.
Sean, have you seen The Convent?
The Convent.
Okay, Adrian Barbeau on a motorcycle killing neon zombie nuns?
No! Dear God Almighty, okay. Give me Add The Convent.
It's actually like from like early 2000.
Yeah.
2000 on the dot, yeah.
Oh my God. Okay. Wish list is happening now.
Yeah, it's really fucking fun.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. Added to my list. Dear God. Okay. Brad, what do you got?
I have, let's see, I guess I'll talk about this because I was so blown away by it. I watched it last night. So I got around to watching A Ghost Story, which I was I had a high anticipation to watch just because, I heard it was shot by the guy that did the DP work for Your Next and VHS. But people are like saying this is visually stunning. And I was like, well, those movies look fine. Well, Your Next looks fine. Your VHS is kind of I don't know what segment he did. I didn't look into it. So
the shaky camera work is amazing.
It was probably Adam Wingard's portion. So anyways, and also with the recent thing of like Casey Affleck, I was like, fuck this guy. But I'm still going to watch movies. Like, I'm not going to be on this fucking tirade of like giving up.
Well, a movie is a bigger animal than just one person in the movie. I'm sorry. Yeah. I mean, you got to kind of approach movies that way because you can't shit on everyone else's hard work based off one person.
Well, I mean, and if you really want to get into it, wait till they actually just start ousting everybody that's a sexual predator.
Watch out, everybody.
And you're not going to have anything. So anyways, but fuck Casey Affleck. But anyways, this movie is absolutely amazing.
Did you eat some pie while you watched it?
No, I didn't eat any pie, but I love that sequence so much. but anyways, I think the quote that's pulled from Time Out New York that's on the front of this, it's lovely, mysterious, and cosmic. And I think that's the best way to sum up this movie. This movie is about loneliness. It's about love. It's so much emotion that's piled into this film. And I'm guessing that you saw it, Sean, since you mentioned the pie scene. Okay, so you're not here. But anyways, is anybody here?
I'm here.
Okay.
Not that I count.
I'm here. Sorry, I had myself muted.
So did you see Ghost Story since you mentioned the pie scene?
No, I have not. It's on my pile to watch. I'm going to watch it soon. But I've heard about that pie scene. Everyone talks about the pie scene. Yeah.
So it's a basic story. I mean, it's nothing, groundbreaking as far as a plot. It's basically a man and woman who are madly in love, and he passes away, and he comes back as a white sheeted ghost, and follows his his wife around. So in order to kind of get that on screen, if someone told me the plot of A Ghost Story, I would laugh, because it's borderline comedic. When that's what I think so great about the film is that even it's this white sheeted ghost and the ghost can communicate, but it's through subtitles. It's almost borderline laughter, but they never get that for being goofy. Like, it's so serious and so heartfelt that it works. I was thinking back, like, how else would you tell a story? Because if you had like a pale Casey Affleck, it wouldn't work. If you had nothing right there, it wouldn't work. So having just someone throw a sheet over their head, it works. And there's a reason for the sheet too. Like, I thought that was pretty clever because I was like, wait, is it supposed to be a ghost? But there's a reason why the sheet is actually on him to begin with. It has so much to digest. Like, I'm still digesting it because number one is just, it's beautifully shot. It's absolutely breathtaking. The sequences, the tracking shots that are done in the film, just the setups, just setting the camera up and just filming. The lighting is absolutely outstanding. Bria Grant actually shows up, which was a nice little surprise. I didn't know she was in the film. But anyways, just a very emotion Very, very, so much emotion in the film. Watching it as the characters, you know, digest what is happening, what they're going through, and for even as the viewer, just dealing with watching this sense of loneliness, because it starts to make you really think about life after death, whether you're religious or not. You know, and there isn't kind of a religious factor to the film either, which I think I was able to connect a little bit better with it, which I'm not a religious person in the slightest. So I always think about death. Death really, really scares me quite a bit, because I try to think, like, is it just like a light turns off? Is that what we have? Or do we actually have this wandering around? Do we actually have a spirit? Is there really a heaven and I'm going to hell? That type of thing. Like, I really think about that a lot in my life. So when I watch something like this, it connects to me on many different levels rather than just watching a movie. It really starts – my gears start to grind upstairs, like, man, like, yeah. is this what it's like for people? Is this what happens?
That's why I've avoided this for so long. Cause I'm like,
if you have something, if you know, cause we know that energy exists in the world. Like, there's energy around, like when people, if you're with a group of friends and someone comes in and, you know, you could feel the hostility, like you could feel that energy, like there is energy in with people and the aura around them. You know, this is the same thing if you're having a fun day at work and then Debbie Downer comes in, mm-hmm. you can actually have this very, like, this shift. You can feel it. Like you're you could feel that, you know, it's like if you're in, you know, fucking Target or something. And with me, this is how I am. Like if someone's at the counter in front of me yelling at an employee about something and it's getting really like, you know, the guy's being very boisterous and voicing his opinion very loudly, I start to get uncomfortable because that energy's pouring. Like if energy is so strong between people and love, which I mean, you know, there's undying love for certain things. Like, can that keep us? Like, is there something here that we're able to, you know, that comes out of us that still stays there? I know that's getting really deep on a review of a movie, but that's how I felt when I'm watching A Ghost Story, because it really connected with me, because I feel like this is something that, you know, could or could not happen. Like, it's very plausible to me. And also then it starts to really weigh on you, is like, do you want that life after death in some aspect? Like, do you want to be alone? Do you want to just be there and no one actually be able to talk to you or see you? Yeah, like it just really gets to you. So it's a wonderful movie. It's what you expect. I think the director said the screenplay was only 20 pages long, and the only reason why it's 20 pages long is because there's actually one scene where a guy talks for about 10 minutes, and that's the only dialogue really in the film. It's completely told just wandering around, but so much. It really shows you that this is by the guy that directs Pete's Dragon, if that tells you anything.
Oh, okay.
So this is his he filmed this movie for like $100,000. And he kept it a secret when he was filming Pete's Dragon, apparently, because, like, you know, he had a big multi-million dollar movie. And then he had this on the side. But it really shows you that you can tell so much in a story by camera work, by direction, by cinematography, that you don't need to have dialogue. Dialogue's fun, characterization's fun, but you can tell a story completely by just visuals. And you spend so little time with these two characters, but their on-screen time that you're with them, you can, you know, with the minimal dialogue that they have, I mean, there are flashbacks throughout the film, but you can feel that chemistry between them, which I really enjoyed. So if you want to maybe have your heart ripped out and then stepped on and then, you know, kissed and caressed and put back in your body and then ripped out again and so on and so forth, watch A Ghost Story, because it's definitely one of those films that's may hit my top 10. I don't know. It really hit me pretty hard. I was very pleasantly surprised. But it's one of those films that hits all levels as far as – and it's – and there are some really, like, scary type moments in it as far as, like, a horror film. But it also has the comedy. It has the drama. Complete sadness to complete happiness. Like, it's all over the place. So highly suggest it for, you know, everybody. Watch it with a personal shopper. I think it's a perfect film to go along with personal shopper, because it hits those same kind of emotions. And, you know, I know it's both kind of ghost stories, but two different ghost stories told from two different point of views, from two different aspects of filmmaking. So yeah. But anyways,
awesome.
Steph.
Oh, wow.
I remembered.
Thank you. I was going to quit, but now I guess I will. Okay. I'm not going to talk about a specific movie. I just thought I'd do like a quick little overview of the George Romero box that just came out from Arrow, the Between Night and Dawn. Say I highly recommend it. I know some people were being a little snooty about it because they're waiting for, you know, like amazing releases of Dawn and everything. But if you're a fan of his, or if you just like to explore more of his career, this is a wonderful set. If you get the box set that's out right now, here, I'll knock on it. I love those Arrow boxes.
They're really great.
The booklet has essays, and two of them are by two of my favorite genre writers, Kat Ellinger and Heather Drain, which is exciting. But we have Season of the Witch, There's Always Vanilla, and The Crazies. The only really more traditional horror one is The Crazies.
Yeah.
And I'm a big fan of that one. I like to do a double feature with Cronenberg's Rabid with that one. That's always a good night. They have great restorations, but the grain is still intact. I watched Season of the Witch the other night, and it looked great. It was beautiful, but still looked like it's from the 70s, which is
and
nice.
It's a super underrated movie too. Like,
it is, yeah. I think it throws people off, kind of like Matt Simber's The Witch Who Came from the Sea, where you kind of see the title and the poster and you expect one thing and get another. But yeah, it was a very emotionally intelligent movie about relationships and everything. And it has the longer cut of the film.
It's like 2 hours, right? Yeah.
104 minutes. And
it's 104?
Yes, the extended version.
Oh, see, I thought the longer version was, I thought it was 2 hours long.
No, the regular cut's 90 minutes.
But... Oh, wow. Okay.
And I watched on the same disc, there's a conversation with Guillermo del Toro interviewing Romero in February of 2016. So it was fairly recent. It's a great conversation. I mean, if you're a fan, you probably have this or it's on your wish list. And I would like to reassure you, this is a beautiful, comprehensive release. They all have commentaries. And if you've been curious, just as long as you go in not expecting a blank of the dead film, it's a wonderful exploration into some of his lesser seen films.
I'm bummed it didn't include Martin, and I don't know where the rights are with
definitely.
That one or the elements, but Martin would be any, I mean, that just needs a Blu-ray release anyway, but yeah, people were complaining about that, but no, I got this set too. I got it from, I bought it from the UK. I know it was released in UK and US, but, I bought
same
it from the UK
here.
To
yeah.
save like $15 or something like that. It was
yeah,
cheaper
I used my Arrow.
UK.
Oh, yeah, okay, the awesome. UK release is a region zero. So even if you don't have an all region player, you can open them.
Yeah, mine's lost in the mail, but I mean, I've seen all the films because I have Like, do I still have my? No, I think I got rid of that the other day. But I have I had season of the Witch on DVD, and that actually included There's Always Vanilla on it, and of course the Crazies have been on Blu-ray. But yeah, I'm not a fan of the Crazies. I've given it a few shots. I used to like it a little bit more when I was younger, but the times that I've rewatched it, I'm just not much into it anymore. But Season of the Witch is definitely one of those Romero films that's, you know, Romero is really great at horror because he has so much social commentary in his films, and he's able to get so much across, telling the horror story as well, telling another story through characterization. And it's really unique watching like two, I mean, Season of the Witch is horror related, but There's Always Vanilla and Season of the Witch are very, very characterized films as far as like, you know, just storytelling and without kind of the horror elements. So it just really shows that Romero is he really was a truly great screenwriter, because he knew what he was doing. He knew what he wanted. And I think that's why his films were so successful. I think we look at him like, oh, that's, you know, the guy that made those zombie movies. And, you know, he has some really great films, as far as like horror movies, but there's just so much more than that. Mm-hmm. You know, he was a filmmaker that, that has some balls. He wasn't afraid to do what he thought was right, I guess, like you could say, or he wasn't afraid to push the envelope as far as like just you know, I mean, having just take Night of the Living Dead. I mean, is right out of the gate, his first feature. Casting a black man as the lead who hits a white woman in the film, and also battles a white guy and kills him. You know, and it's like, man, in 1968, seeing that on the screen, as big as of a movie as Night of the Living Dead was, that's some heavy shit. Like, Romero was not afraid to do that. And, you know, and then his follow-up films are, you know, There's Always Vanilla and Season of the Witch was just, you know, just a different direction for him. And then he got back onto the horror with, you know, The Crazies and then Martin and then Knight Riders and then Dawn. But yeah, just a truly great filmmaker all around. So
cool. I can't wait to dive into this set.
Yeah, mine's lost in the mail, but
damn it.
We'll see it. I mean, I've seen the films, but I kind of want to see There's Always Vanilla in HD because it's always had a really shitty DVD. Like I said, it was a combo on that DVD, and it's just really shitty quality. So,
well, all right. We need to wrap up. So this is an almost 2-hour What's on Your Doorstep segment. So I think we're gonna try to see if we, you know, maybe we do one of these every other week, or I don't know. We're messing around trying to, you know, we're experimenting with some things for next year. We're gonna be redoing kind of the Patreon. I know that we haven't been able to do the extra shows like we've wanted to. It's tough. Scheduling's tough. We're busy. We all do this as a hobby. So if you want to pitch in for Patreon, that's awesome. Awesome. We're really not going to be bugging everyone about that, but we will be revamping it for sure. And so more details on that as we kind of retool it. But we just got a new patron, so thank you. I should have this up. I just got the email, and I'm waiting for these. Carolyn Crawford, thank you for becoming a new.
That's my patron. Mom.
Is it your mom? It's your mom. Stephanie's mom, everybody. Stephanie's mom. Thank you so much.
That's adorable.
That's awesome. Anyway, so anyway, more info about that. Just my schedule is crazy. We're going to be taking January off to kind of retool the show a little bit and come back with something that works for all of our schedules. So anyway, we'd love to hear from you guys. If you guys have any suggestions for the Patreon and things like that, that'd be great. We'd love to keep doing the extra shows, but it's tough. My schedule's tough, Brett. I mean, there's the time difference to do another show each week. Kind of gets a bit, you know, tricky. But anyway, please support our sponsors, Vinegar Syndrome, of course. We'll be doing a Vinegar Syndrome episode very soon. My dog, hey, you little shit. My dog's attacking a Coke Zero 12-pack. It's like the last
real
one.
Coke Zero?
The last, yeah, real Coke Zero. It's like I have the last 24-pack in existence. Shout out to Coffee Shop of Horrors. Please support them. They have some products of the month. They are doing a 10% discount on Clarence Hot Chocolate, which is brew coffee V4 Vanilla Cinnamon, and then Kill Devil Rumble. Those flavors are on sale. So, my dog. Grindhouse Video, of course. Check them out, grindhousevideo.com. Music by Wolfman of Mars, and art by Kevin Spencer and Ink Spatters. Okay. Are you done? All right. I thank all you guys for listening. We'll be back next time. We're trying to organize our next few shows. We're trying to get the director of The Barn. And, of course, we have our Vinegar Syndrome episode that we will be lining up to do as well. And then we have other things, other goodies to get to as well. So thank you, everyone, for listening. Brad and Steph, do you have anything to add to my spiel?
Is that Noah?
Noah is in the room now, too, and two dogs.
Yay, everybody.
It wouldn't be a screamcast if I was not consistently interrupted.
I like it.
All right. All right.
Yeah, well, Steph was going to say something. She's got something to add.
I was just thank you for listening, and we do really appreciate feedback, and big shout out to my mom.
Very nice.
I'm gonna see if my mom can be a Patreon.
Stephanie, you have a review of Thelma up on the site, so everyone please check that out at thescreamcast.com. All of our social media links are all there. As well, please subscribe to the show on oneofus.net. Support oneofus.net if you can. We do have our iTunes and Google Play and all that kind of stuff, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, and all that. All right, I'm going to go before more people end up in my room.
Cool.
All right.
Bye.
All right, see ya.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Oh, don't tell me you're leaving. Party's just begun.
OneOfUs.net has been your one-stop shop for all things geek for years. But there's a side to them many of you have never heard. The subscription side. Subscribe and listen to great podcasts like The Breakfast Pub, The Original Gentleman, and the Watch a Movie With Us series. Head on over to OneOfUs.net and don't forget your towel.